extractive feedback, with extractive political institutions forging extractive economic institutions, which in turn create the basis for the persistence of extractive political institutions. We saw this most clearly in the case of Guatemala, where the same elite held power, first under colonial rule, then in independent Guatemala, for more than four centuries. Extractive institutions enrich the elite, and their wealth forms the basis for the continuation of their domination. The same process of the vicious circle is also apparent in the persistence of the plantation economy in the U.S. South, except that it also showcases the vicious circle's great resilience in the face of challenges. U.S. Southern planters lost their formal control of economic and political institutions after their defeat in the Civil War. Slavery, which was the basis of the plantation economy, was abolished, and blacks were given equal political and economic rights. Yet the Civil War did not destroy the political power of the planter elite or its economic basis, and they were able to restructure the system, under a different guise, but still under their own local political control, and to achieve the same objective, abundance of low-cost labor for the plantations. This form of the vicious circle, where extractive institutions persist because the elite controlling them and benefiting from them persists, is not its only form. At first, a more puzzling, but no less real and no less vicious form of negative feedback shaped the political and economic development of many nations and is exemplified by the post-colonial experiences of much of sub-Saharan Africa, in particular Sierra Leone and Ethiopia, in a form that the sociologist Robert Michel would recognize as the iron law of oligarchy. The overthrow of a regime presiding over extractive institutions heralds the arrival of a new set of masters to exploit the same set of pernicious extractive institutions. The logic of this type of vicious circle is also simple to understand in hindsight. Extractive political institutions create few constraints on the exercise of power, so there are essentially no institutions to restrain the use and abuse of power by those overthrowing previous dictators and assuming control of the state. And extractive economic institutions imply that there are great profits and wealth to be made merely by controlling power, expropriating the assets of others, and setting up monopolies. Of course, the iron law of oligarchy is not a true law in the sense that the laws of physics are. It does not chart an inevitable path, as the Glorious Revolution in England or the Meiji Restoration in Japan illustrate. A key factor in these episodes, which saw a major turn toward inclusive institutions, was the empowerment of a broad coalition that could stand up against absolutism and would replace the absolutist institutions by more inclusive, pluralistic ones. A revolution by a broad coalition makes the emergence of pluralistic political institutions much more likely. In Sierra Leone and Ethiopia, the iron law of oligarchy was made more likely not only because existing institutions were highly extractive, but also because neither the independence movement in the former nor the Derg coup in the latter were revolutions led by such broad coalitions, but rather by individuals and groups seeking power so that they could do the extracting. There is yet another, even more destructive facet of the vicious circle, anticipated by our discussion of the Maya city-states in Chapter 5. When extractive institutions create huge inequalities in society and great wealth and unchecked power for those in control, there will be many wishing to fight to take control of the state and institutions. Extractive institutions then not only pave the way for the next regime, which will be even more extractive, but they also engender continuous infighting and civil wars. These civil wars then cause more human suffering and also destroy even what state centralization these societies have achieved. This also often starts a process of descent into lawlessness, state failure, and political chaos, crushing all hopes of economic prosperity, as the next chapter will illustrate. Chapter 13. Why Nations Fail Today. How to Win the Lottery in Zimbabwe. It was January 2000 in Harare, Zimbabwe. Master of Ceremonies, Falat Chihuahua, was in charge of drawing the winning ticket for the national lottery, organized by a partly state-owned bank, the Zimbabwe Banking Corporation, Zimbank. The lottery was open to all clients who had kept 5,000 or more Zimbabwe dollars in their accounts during December 1999. When Chihuahua drew the ticket, he was dumbfounded. As the public statement of Zimbank put it, Master of Ceremonies Falat Chihuahua could hardly believe his eyes when the ticket drawn for the 100,000 Zimbabwean dollar prize was handed to him and he saw His Excellency R.G. Mugabe written on it. President Robert Mugabe, who had ruled Zimbabwe by hook or by crook, and usually with an iron fist since 1980, had won the lottery, which was worth 100,000 Zimbabwe dollars, about five times the annual per capita income of the country. Zimbank claimed that Mr. Mugabe's name had been drawn from among thousands of eligible customers. What a lucky man! Needless to say, he didn't really need the money. Mugabe had in fact only recently awarded himself and his cabinet salary hikes of up to 200%. The lottery ticket was just one more indication of Zimbabwe's extractive institutions. One could call this corruption, but it is just a symptom of the institutional malaise in Zimbabwe. The fact that Mugabe could even win the lottery if he wanted showed how much control he had over matters in Zimbabwe and gave the world a glimpse of the extent of the country's extractive institutions. The most common reason why nations fail today is because they have extractive institutions. Zimbabwe, under Mugabe's regime, vividly illustrates the economic and social consequences. Though the national statistics in Zimbabwe are very unreliable, the best estimate is that by 2008, Zimbabwe's per capita income was about half of what it was when the country gained its independence in 1980. Dramatic as this sounds, it does not in fact begin to capture the deterioration in living standards in Zimbabwe. The state has collapsed and more or less stopped providing any basic public services. In 2008 to 2009, the deterioration in the health systems led to an outbreak of cholera across the country. As of January 10, 2010, there have been 98,741 reported cases and 4,293 deaths, making it the deadliest cholera outbreak in Africa over the previous 15 years. In the meantime, mass unemployment has also reached unprecedented levels. In early 2009, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs claimed that the unemployment rate had hit an incredible 94%. The roots of many economic and political institutions in Zimbabwe, as is the case for much of sub-Saharan Africa, can be traced back to the colonial period. In 1890, Cecil Rhodes's British South Africa Company sent a military expedition into the then kingdom of the Ndebele, based in Matabeleland, and also into the neighboring Mashonaland. Their superior weaponry quickly suppressed African resistance, and by 1901, the colony of Southern Rhodesia, named after Rhodes, had been formed in the area that is currently Zimbabwe. Now that the area was a privately owned concession of the British South Africa Company, Rhodes anticipated making money there through prospecting and mining for precious minerals. The ventures never got off the ground, but the very rich farmlands began attracting white migration. These settlers soon annexed much of the land. By 1923, they had freed themselves from the rule of the British South Africa Company and persuaded the British government to grant them self-government. What then occurred is very similar to what had happened in South Africa a decade or so previously. The 1913 Natives Land Act created a dual economy in South Africa. Rhodesia passed very similar laws, and inspired by the South African model, a white-only apartheid state was constructed soon after 1923. As the European colonial empires collapsed in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the white elite in Rhodesia, led by Ian Smith, comprising possibly 5% of the population, declared independence from Britain in 1965. Few international governments recognized Rhodesia's independence, and the United Nations levied economic and political sanctions against it. The black citizens organized a guerrilla war from bases in the neighboring countries of Mozambique and Zambia. International pressure and the rebellion waged by the two main groups, Mugabe's ZANU, the Zimbabwe African National Union, and ZAPU, the Zimbabwe African People's Union, led by Joshua Nkomo, resulted in a negotiated end to white rule. The state of Zimbabwe was created in 1980. After independence, Mugabe quickly established his personal control. He either violently eliminated his opponents or co-opted them. The most egregious acts of violence happened in Matabeleland, the heartland of support for ZAPU, where as many as 20,000 people were killed in the early 1980s. By 1987, ZAPU had merged with ZANU to create ZANU-PF, and Joshua Nkomo was sidelined politically. Mugabe was able to rewrite the constitution he had inherited as a part of the independence negotiation, making himself president. He had started as prime minister, abolishing white voter rolls that were part of the independence agreement, and eventually, in 1990, getting rid of the Senate altogether and introducing positions in the legislature that he could nominate. A de facto one-party state headed by Mugabe was the result. Upon independence, Mugabe took over a set of extractive economic institutions created by the white regime. These included a host of regulations on prices and international trade, state-run industries, and the obligatory agricultural marketing boards. State employment expanded rapidly, with jobs given to supporters of ZANU-PF. The tight government regulation of the economy suited the ZANU-PF elites, because it made it difficult for an independent class of African businessmen, who might then have challenged the former political monopoly, to emerge. This was very similar to the situation we saw in Ghana in the 1960s in Chapter 2. Ironically, of course, this left whites as the main business class. During this period, the main strengths of the white economy, particularly the highly productive agricultural export sector, was left untouched. But this would last only until Mugabe became unpopular. The model of regulation and market intervention gradually became unsustainable, and the process of institutional change, with the support of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, began in 1991 after a severe fiscal crisis. The deteriorating economic performance finally led to the emergence of a serious political opposition to ZANU-PF's one-party rule, the Movement for Democratic Change, MDC. The 1995 parliamentary elections were far from competitive. ZANU-PF won 81% of the vote and 118 out of the 120 seats. 55 of these members of parliament were elected unopposed. The presidential election the following year showed even more signs of irregularities and fraud. Mugabe won 93% of the vote, but his two opponents, Abel Muzorea and Ndabaningi Sithole, had already withdrawn their candidacy prior to the election, accusing the government of coercion and fraud. After 2000, despite all the corruption, ZANU-PF's grip was weakening. It took only 49% of the popular vote, and only 63 seats. All were contested by the MDC, who took every seat in the capital, Harare. In the presidential election of 2002, Mugabe scraped home with only 56% of the vote. Both sets of elections went ZANU-PF's way only because of violence and intimidation, coupled with electoral fraud. The response of Mugabe to the breakdown of his political control was to intensify both the repression and the use of government policies to buy support. He unleashed a full-scale assault on white landowners. Starting in 2000, he encouraged and supported an extensive series of land occupations and expropriations. They were often led by war veterans associations, groups supposedly comprised of former combatants in the War of Independence. Some of the expropriated land was given to these groups, but much of it also went to the ZANU-PF elites. The insecurity of property rights wrought by Mugabe and ZANU-PF led to a collapse of agricultural output and productivity. As the economy crumbled, the only thing left was to print money to buy support, which led to enormous hyperinflation. In January 2009, it became legal to use other currencies, such as the South African rand, and the Zimbabwean dollar vanished from circulation, a worthless piece of paper. What happened in Zimbabwe after 1980 was commonplace in sub-Saharan Africa since independence. Zimbabwe inherited a set of highly extractive political and economic institutions in 1980. For the first decade and a half, these were maintained relatively untouched. While elections took place, political institutions were anything but inclusive. Economic institutions changed somewhat. For example, there was no longer explicit discrimination against blacks. But on the whole, the institutions remained extractive, with the only difference being that instead of Ian Smith and the whites doing the extracting, it was Robert Mugabe and the ZANU-PF elites filling their pockets. Over time, the institutions became even more extractive, and incomes in Zimbabwe collapsed. The economic and political failure in Zimbabwe is yet another manifestation of the iron law of oligarchy. In this instance, with the extractive and repressive regime of Ian Smith being replaced by the extractive, corrupt, and repressive regime of Robert Mugabe. Mugabe's fake lottery win in 2000 was then simply the tip of a very corrupt and historically shaped iceberg. Nations fail today because their extractive economic institutions do not create the incentives needed for people to save, invest, and innovate. Extractive political institutions support these economic institutions by cementing the power of those who benefit from the extraction. Extractive economic and political institutions, though their details vary under different circumstances, are always at the root of this failure. In many cases, for example, as we will see in Argentina, Colombia, and Egypt, this failure takes the form of lack of sufficient economic activity, because the politicians are just too happy to extract resources or quash any type of independent economic activity that threatens themselves and the economic elites. In some extreme cases, as in Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone, which we discuss next, extractive institutions pave the way for complete state failure, destroying not only law and order, but also even the most basic economic incentives. The result is economic stagnation, and as the recent history of Angola, Cameroon, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, Liberia, Nepal, Sierra Leone, Sudan, and Zimbabwe illustrates, civil wars, mass displacements, famines, and epidemics, making many of these countries poorer today than they were in the 1960s. A Children's Crusade? On March 23, 1991, a group of armed men under the leadership of Fode Sanko crossed the border from Liberia into Sierra Leone and attacked the southern frontier town of Kailahun. Sanko, formerly a corporal in the Sierra Leonean Army, and been imprisoned after taking part in an abortive coup against Shaka Stevens' government in 1971. After being released, he eventually ended up in Libya, where he entered a training camp that the Libyan dictator Colonel Gaddafi ran for African revolutionaries. There he met Charles Taylor, who was plotting to overthrow the government in Liberia. When Taylor invaded Liberia on Christmas Eve 1989, Sanko was with him. And it was with a group of Taylor's men, mostly Liberians and Burkinabes, citizens of Burkina Faso, that Sanko invaded Sierra Leone. They called themselves the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, and they announced that they were there to overthrow the corrupt and tyrannical government of the APC. As we saw in the previous chapter, Shaka Stevens and his All People's Congress, the APC, took over and intensified the extractive institutions of colonial rule in Sierra Leone, just as Mugabe and ZANU-PF did in Zimbabwe. By 1985, when Stevens, ill with cancer, brought in Joseph Momo to replace him, the economy was collapsing. Stevens, apparently without irony, used to enjoy quoting the aphorism, "The cow eats where it is tethered," and where Stevens had once eaten, Momo now gorged. The roads fell to pieces, and schools disintegrated. National television broadcasts stopped in 1987, when the transmitter was sold by the Minister of Information, and in 1989, a radio tower that relayed radio signals outside Freetown fell down, ending transmissions outside the capital. An analysis published in a newspaper in the capital city of Freetown in 1995 rings very true. By the end of Momo's rule, he had stopped paying civil servants, teachers, and even paramount chiefs. Central government had collapsed, and then, of course, we had border incursions, rebels, and all the automatic weapons pouring over the border from Liberia. The NPRC, the rebels, and the Sobels, soldiers turned rebels, all amount to the chaos one expects when government disappears. None of them are the causes of our problems, but they are symptoms. The collapse of the state under Momo, once again a consequence of the vicious circle unleashed by the extreme extractive institutions under Stevens, meant that there was nothing to stop the RUF from coming across the border in 1991. The state had no capacity to oppose it. Stevens had already emasculated the military because he worried they might overthrow him. It was then easy for a relatively small number of armed men to create chaos in most of the country. They even had a manifesto called Footpaths to Democracy, which started with a quote from the black intellectual Frantz Fanon. Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. The section, What Are We Fighting For?, begins, We continue to fight because we are tired of being perpetual victims of state-sponsored poverty and human degradation, visited on us by years of autocratic rule and militarism. But we shall exercise restraint and continue to wait patiently at the rendezvous of peace, where we shall all be winners. We are committed to peace by any means necessary. But what we are not committed to is becoming victims of peace. We know our cause to be just, and God, Allah, will never abandon us in our struggle to reconstruct a new Sierra Leone. Though Sanko and other RUF leaders may have started with political grievances, and the grievances of the people suffering under the APC's extractive institutions may have encouraged them to join the movement early on, the situation quickly changed and spun out of control. The mission of the RUF plunged the country into agony, as in the testimony of a teenager from Gioma, in the south of Sierra Leone. They gathered some of us. They chose some of our friends and killed them, two of them. These were people whose fathers were the chiefs, and they had soldiers' boots and property in their houses. They were shot for no other reason than that they were accused of harboring soldiers. The chiefs were also killed as part of the government. They chose someone to be the new chief. They were still saying they had come to free us from the APC. After a point, they were not choosing people to kill, just shooting people. In the first year of the invasion, any intellectual roots that the RUF may have had were completely extinguished. Sanko executed those who criticized the mounting stream of atrocities. Soon, few voluntarily joined the RUF. Instead, they turned to forcible recruitment, particularly of children. Indeed, all sides did this, including the army. If the Sierra Leonean Civil War was a crusade to build a better society, in the end, it was a children's crusade. The conflict intensified with massacres and massive human rights abuses, including mass rapes and the amputation of hands and ears. When the RUF took over areas, they also engaged in economic exploitation. It was most obvious in the diamond mining areas, where they press-ganged people into diamond mining, but was widespread elsewhere as well. The RUF wasn't alone in committing atrocities, massacres, and organized forced labor. The government did so as well. Such was the collapse of law and order that it became difficult for people to tell who was a soldier and who was a rebel. Military discipline completely vanished. By the time the war ended in 2001, probably 80,000 people had died, and the whole country had been devastated. Roads, houses, and buildings were entirely destroyed. Today, if you go to Koidu, a major diamond-producing area in the east, you'll still see rows of burned-out houses scarred with bullet holes. By 1991, the state in Sierra Leone had totally failed. Think of what King Shyam started with the Bushong. He set up extractive institutions to cement his power and extract the output the rest of society would produce. But even extractive institutions with central authority concentrated in his hands, were an improvement over the situation without any law and order, central authority, or property rights that characterized the Lele society on the other side of the River Kasai. Such lack of order and central authority has been the fate of many African nations in recent decades, partly because the process of political centralization was historically delayed in much of sub-Saharan Africa, but also because the vicious circle of extractive institutions reversed any state centralization that existed, paving the way for state failure. Sierra Leone, during her bloody civil war of 10 years from 1991 to 2001, was a typical case of a failed state. It started out as just another country marred by extractive institutions, albeit of a particularly vicious and inefficient type. Countries become failed states not because of their geography or their culture, but because of the legacy of extractive institutions, which concentrate power and wealth in the hands of those controlling the state, opening the way for unrest, strife, and civil war. Extractive institutions also directly contribute to the gradual failing of the state by neglecting investment in the most basic public services, exactly what happened in Sierra Leone. Extractive institutions that expropriate and impoverish the people and block economic development are quite common in Africa, Asia, and South America. Charles Taylor helped to start the civil war in Sierra Leone, while at the same time initiating a savage conflict in Liberia, which led to state failure there, too. The pattern of extractive institutions collapsing into civil war and state failure has happened elsewhere in Africa, for example, in Angola, Cote d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, Republic of Congo, Somalia, Sudan, and Uganda. Extraction paves the way for conflict, not unlike the conflict that the highly extractive institutions of the Maya city-states generated almost 1,000 years ago. Conflict precipitates state failure, so another reason why nations fail today is that their states fail. This, in turn, is a consequence of decades of rule under extractive economic and political institutions. Who is the state? The cases of Zimbabwe, Somalia, and Sierra Leone, even if typical of poor countries in Africa, and perhaps even some in Asia, seem rather extreme. Surely Latin American countries do not have failed states. Surely their presidents are not brazen enough to win the lottery. In Colombia, the Andean Mountains gradually merge to the north with a large coastal plain that borders the Caribbean Ocean. Colombians call this the Tierra Caliente, the hot country, as distinct from the Andean world of the Tierra Fría, the cold country. For the last 50 years, Colombia has been regarded by most political scientists and governments as a democracy. The United States feels happy to negotiate a potential free trade agreement with the country and pours all kinds of aid into it, particularly military aid. After a short-lived military government, which ended in 1958, elections have been regularly held, even though until 1974 a pact rotated political power and the presidency between the two traditional political parties, the conservatives and the liberals. Still, this pact, the National Front, was itself ratified by the Colombian people via a plebiscite, and this all seems democratic enough. Yet while Colombia has a long history of democratic elections, it does not have inclusive institutions. Instead, its history has been marred by violations of civil liberties, extrajudicial executions, violence against civilians, and civil war. Not the sort of outcomes we expect from a democracy. The civil war in Colombia is different from that in Sierra Leone, where the state and society collapsed and chaos reigned. But it is a civil war nonetheless, and one that has caused far more casualties. The military rule of the 1950s was itself partially in response to a civil war known in Spanish simply as La Violencia, or the violence. Since that time, quite a range of insurgent groups, mostly communist revolutionaries, have plagued the countryside, kidnapping and murdering. To avoid either of these unpleasant options in rural Colombia, you have to pay the vacuna, literally the vaccination, meaning that you have to vaccinate yourself against being murdered or kidnapped by paying off some group of armed thugs each month. Not all armed groups in Colombia are communists. In 1981, members of the main communist guerrilla group in Colombia, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, kidnapped a dairy farmer, Jesus Castaño, who lived in a small town called Amalfi in the hot country in the northeastern part of the Department of Antioquia. The FARC demanded a ransom amounting to $7,500, a small fortune in rural Colombia. The family raised it by mortgaging the farm, but their father's corpse was found anyway, chained to a tree. Enough was enough for three of Castaño's sons, Carlos, Fidel, and Vicente. They founded a paramilitary group, Los Tanqueros, to hunt down members of the FARC and avenge this act. The brothers were good at organizing, and soon their group grew and began to find a common interest with other similar paramilitary groups that had developed from similar causes. Colombians in many areas were suffering at the hands of left-wing guerrillas, and right-wing paramilitaries formed in opposition. Paramilitaries were being used by landowners to defend themselves against the guerrillas. But they were also involved in drug trafficking, extortion, and the kidnapping and murder of citizens. By 1997, the paramilitaries, under the leadership of the Castaño brothers, had managed to form a national organization for paramilitaries called the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, the AUC, United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia. The AUC expanded into large parts of the country, particularly into the hot country, in the departments of Córdoba, Sucre, Magdalena, and Cesar. By 2001, the AUC may have had as many as 30,000 armed men at its disposal and was organized into different blocks. In Córdoba, the paramilitary Bloque Catatumbo was led by Salvatore Mancuso. As its power continued to grow, the AUC made a strategic decision to get involved in politics. Paramilitaries and politicians courted each other. Several of the leaders of the AUC organized a meeting with prominent politicians in the town of Santa Fe de Ralito in Córdoba. A joint document, a pact, calling for the refounding of the country was issued and signed by leading members of the AUC, such as Jorge Cuarenta, the nickname for Rodrigo Tovar Pupo, Adolfo Paz, a nom de guerre for Diego Fernando Don Berna Morillo, and Diego Vecino, real name, Eduard Cobo Telles. Along with politicians, including national senators William Montes and Miguel de la Estrella. By this point, the AUC was running large tracts of Colombia, and it was easy for them to fix who got elected in the 2002 elections for the Congress and Senate. For example, in the municipality of San Onofre in Sucre, the election was arranged by the paramilitary leader Cadena, Chain. One eyewitness described what happened as follows. The truck sent by Cadena went around the neighborhoods, corregimientos, and rural areas of San Onofre, picking people up. According to some inhabitants, for the 2002 elections, hundreds of peasants were taken to the Corregimiento Plan Parejo so they could see the faces of the candidates they had to vote for in the parliamentarian elections. Jairo Merlano for Senate and Muriel Benito Rebollo for Congress. Cadena put in a bag the names of the members of the municipal council, took out two, and said that he would kill them and other people chosen randomly if Muriel did not win. The threat seems to have worked. Each candidate obtained 40,000 votes in the whole of Sucre. It is no surprise that the mayor of San Onofre signed the Pact of Santa Fe de Ralito. Probably one-third of the congressmen and senators owed their election in 2002 to paramilitary support. And map 20, which depicts the areas of Colombia under paramilitary control, shows how widespread their hold was. Salvatore Mancuso himself put it in an interview in the following way. 35% of the Congress was elected in areas where there were states of the self-defense groups. In those states, we were the ones collecting taxes. We delivered justice. And we had the military and territorial control of the region, and all the people who wanted to go into politics had to come and deal with the political representatives we had there. It is not difficult to imagine the effect of this extent of paramilitary control of politics and society on economic institutions and public policy. The expansion of the AUC was not a peaceful affair. The group not only fought against the FARC, but also murdered innocent civilians and terrorized and displaced hundreds of thousands of people from their homes. According to the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, IDMC, of the Norwegian Refugee Council, in early 2010, around 10% of Colombia's population, nearly 4.5 million people, was internally displaced. The paramilitaries also, as Mancuso suggested, took over the government and all its functions, except that the taxes they collected were just expropriation for their own pockets. An extraordinary pact between the paramilitary leader Martin Llanos, real name Hector Herman Buitrago, and the mayors of the municipalities of Tauramena, Agua Azul, Mani, Villanueva, Monterrey, and Sabana Larga, in the department of Casanare in eastern Colombia, lists the following rules to which the mayors had to adhere by order of the paramilitary peasants of Casanare. Number 9. Give 50% of the municipality budget to be managed by the paramilitary peasants of Casanare. Number 10. 10% of each and every contract of the municipality to be given to the paramilitary peasants of Casanare. Number 11. Mandatory assistance to all the meetings called by the paramilitary peasants of Casanare. Number 12. Inclusion of the paramilitary peasants of Casanare in every infrastructure project. Number 13. Affiliation to the new political party formed by the paramilitary peasants of Casanare. Number 14. Accomplishment of his or hers governance program. Casanare is not a poor department. On the contrary, it has the highest level of per capita income of any Colombian department, because it has significant oil deposits, just the kind of resources that attract paramilitaries. In fact, once they gained power, the paramilitaries intensified their systematic expropriation of property. Mancuso himself reputedly accumulated $25 million worth of urban and rural property. Estimates of land expropriated in Colombia by paramilitaries are as high as 10% of all rural land. Colombia is not a case of a failed state about to collapse, but it is a state without sufficient centralization and with far from complete authority over all its territory. Though the state is able to provide security and public services in large urban areas such as Bogotá and Barranquilla, there are significant parts of the country where it provides few public services and almost no law and order. Instead, alternative groups and people, such as Mancuso, control politics and resources. In parts of the country, economic institutions function quite well, and there are high levels of human capital and entrepreneurial skill. In other parts, the institutions are highly extractive, even failing to provide a minimal degree of state authority. It might be hard to understand how a situation like this can sustain itself for decades, even centuries. But in fact, the situation has a logic of its own, as a type of vicious circle. Violence and the absence of centralized state institutions of this type enter into a symbiotic relationship with politicians running the functional parts of the society. The symbiotic relationship arises because national politicians exploit the lawlessness in peripheral parts of the country, while paramilitary groups are left to their own devices by the national government. This pattern became particularly apparent in the 2000s. In 2002, the presidential election was won by Álvaro Uribe. Uribe had something in common with the Castaño brothers. His father had been killed by the FARC. Uribe ran a campaign repudiating the attempts of the previous administration to try to make peace with the FARC. In 2002, his vote share was 3 percentage points higher in areas with paramilitaries than without them. In 2006, when he was reelected, his vote share was 11 percentage points higher in such areas. If Mancuso and his partners could deliver the vote for Congress and the Senate, they could do so in presidential elections as well, particularly for a president strongly aligned with their worldview and likely to be lenient on them. As Jairo Angarita, Salvatore Mancuso's deputy and the former leader of the AUC Sino and San Jorge blocs, declared in September 2005, he was proud to work for the re-election of the best president we have ever had. Once elected, the paramilitary senators and congressmen voted for what Uribe wanted, in particular, changing the Constitution so that he could be re-elected in 2006, which had not been allowed at the time of his first election in 2002. In exchange, President Uribe delivered a highly lenient law that allowed the paramilitaries to demobilize. Demobilization did not mean the end of paramilitarism, simply its institutionalization in large parts of Colombia and the Colombian state, which the paramilitaries had taken over and were allowed to keep. In Colombia, many aspects of economic and political institutions have become more inclusive over time. But certain major extractive elements remain. Lawlessness and insecure property rights are endemic in large swaths of the country, and this is a consequence of the lack of control by the national state in many parts of the country, and the particular form of lack of state centralization in Colombia. But this state of affairs is not an inevitable outcome. It is itself a consequence of dynamics mirroring the vicious circle. Political institutions in Colombia do not generate incentives for politicians to provide public services and law and order in much of the country, and do not put enough constraints on them to prevent them from entering into implicit or explicit deals with paramilitaries and thugs. El Corralito. Argentina was in the grip of an economic crisis in late 2001. For 3 years, income had been falling, unemployment had been rising, and the country had accumulated a massive international debt. The policies leading to this situation were adopted after 1989 by the government of Carlos Menem to stop hyperinflation and stabilize the economy. For a time, they were successful. In 1991, Menem tied the Argentine peso to the U.S. dollar. One peso was equal to $1 by law. There was to be no change in the exchange rate. End of story. Well, almost. To convince people that the government really meant to stick to the law, it persuaded people to open bank accounts in U.S. dollars. Dollars could be used in the shops of the capital city of Buenos Aires and withdrawn from cash machines all over the city. This policy may have helped stabilize the economy, but it had one big drawback. It made Argentine exports very expensive and foreign imports very cheap. Exports dribbled to a halt. Imports gushed in. The only way to pay for them was to borrow. It was an unsustainable situation. As more people began worrying about the sustainability of the peso, they put more of their wealth into dollar accounts at banks. After all, if the government ripped up the law and devalued the peso, they would be safe with dollar accounts, right? They were right to be worried about the peso, but they were too optimistic about their dollars. On December 1, 2001, the government froze all bank accounts, initially for 90 days. Only a small amount of cash was allowed for a withdrawal on a weekly basis. First, it was 250 pesos, still worth $250. Then, 300 pesos. But this was allowed to be withdrawn only from peso accounts. Nobody was allowed to withdraw money from their dollar accounts unless they agreed to convert the dollars into pesos. Nobody wanted to do so. Argentines dubbed this situation El Corralito, the little corral. Depositors were hemmed into a corral like cows with nowhere to go. In January, the devaluation was finally enacted, and instead of there being 1 peso for $1, there were soon 4 pesos for $1. This should have been a vindication of those who thought they should put their savings in dollars, but it wasn't, because the government then forcibly converted all the dollar bank accounts into pesos, but at the old one-for-one exchange rate. Someone who had had $1,000 saved suddenly found himself with only $250. The government had expropriated three-quarters of people's savings. For economists, Argentina is a perplexing country. To illustrate how difficult it was to understand Argentina, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Simon Kuznets once famously remarked that there were four sorts of countries: developed, underdeveloped, Japan, and Argentina. Kuznets thought so because, around the time of the First World War, Argentina was one of the richest countries in the world. It then began a steady decline relative to the other rich countries in Western Europe and North America, which turned, in the 1970s and 80s, into an absolute decline. On the surface of it, Argentina's economic performance is puzzling, but the reasons for its decline become clearer when looked at through the lens of inclusive and extractive institutions. It is true that before 1914, Argentina experienced around 50 years of economic growth, but this was a classic case of growth under extractive institutions. Argentina was then ruled by a narrow elite, heavily invested in the agricultural export economy. The economy grew by exporting beef, hides, and grain in the middle of a boom in the world prices of these commodities. Like all such experiences of growth under extractive institutions, it involved no creative destruction and no innovation, and it was not sustainable. Around the time of the First World War, mounting political instability and armed revolts induced the Argentine elites to try to broaden the political system, but this led to the mobilization of forces they could not control, and in 1930 came the first military coup. Between then and 1983, Argentina oscillated backward and forward between dictatorship and democracy, and between various extractive institutions. There was mass repression under military rule, which peaked in the 1970s, with at least 9,000 people, and probably far more, being illegally executed. Hundreds of thousands were imprisoned and tortured. During the periods of civilian rule, there were elections, a democracy of sorts, but the political system was far from inclusive. Since the rise of Perón in the 1940s, democratic Argentina has been dominated by the political party he created, the Partido Justicialista, usually just called the Peronist Party. The Peronists won elections thanks to a huge political machine, which succeeded by buying votes, dispensing patronage, and engaging in corruption, including government contracts and jobs in exchange for political support. In a sense, this was a democracy, but it was not pluralistic. Power was highly concentrated in the Peronist Party, which faced few constraints on what it could do, at least in the period when the military restrained from throwing it from power. As we saw earlier, if the Supreme Court challenged a policy, so much the worse for the Supreme Court. In the 1940s, Perón had cultivated the labor movement as a political base. When it was weakened by military repression in the 1970s and 80s, his party simply switched to buying votes from others instead. Economic policies and institutions were designed to deliver income to their supporters, not to create a level playing field. When President Menem faced a term limit that kept him from being re-elected in the 1990s, it was just more of the same. He could simply rewrite the Constitution and get rid of the term limit. As El Corralito shows, even if Argentina has elections and popularly elected governments, the government is quite able to override property rights and expropriate its own citizens with impunity. There is little check on Argentine presidents and political elites, and certainly no pluralism. What puzzled Kuznets, and no doubt many others who visited Buenos Aires, is that the city seems so different from Lima, Guatemala City, or even Mexico City. You do not see indigenous people, and you do not see the descendants of former slaves. Mostly you see the glorious architecture and buildings put up during the Belle Epoque, the years of growth under extractive institutions. But in Buenos Aires, you see only part of Argentina. Menem, for example, was not from Buenos Aires. He was born in Aniaco, in the province of La Rioja, in the mountains far to the northwest of Buenos Aires, and he served 3 terms as governor of the province. At the time of the conquest of the Americas by the Spanish, this area of Argentina was an outlying part of the Inca Empire and had a dense population of indigenous people. See Map 1. The Spanish created encomiendas here, and a highly extractive economy developed, growing food and breeding mules for the miners in Potosí to the north. In fact, La Rioja was much more like the area of Potosí in Peru and Bolivia than it was like Buenos Aires. In the 19th century, La Rioja produced the famous warlord Facundo Quiroga, who ruled the area lawlessly and marched his army on Buenos Aires. The story about the development of Argentine political institutions is a story about how the interior provinces, such as La Rioja, reached agreements with Buenos Aires. These agreements were a truce. The warlords of La Rioja agreed to leave Buenos Aires alone so that it could make money. In return, the Buenos Aires elites gave up on reforming the institutions of the interior. So, Argentina at first appears a world apart from Peru or Bolivia, but it is really not so different once you leave the elegant boulevards of Buenos Aires. That the preferences and the politics of the interior got embedded into Argentine institutions is the reason why the country has experienced a very similar institutional path to those of other extractive Latin American countries. That elections have not brought either inclusive political or economic institutions is the typical case in Latin America. In Colombia, paramilitaries can fix one-third of national elections. In Venezuela today, as in Argentina, the democratically elected government of Hugo Chavez attacks its opponents, fires them from public sector jobs, closes down newspapers whose editorials it doesn't like, and expropriates property. In whatever he does, Chavez is much more powerful and less constrained than Sir Robert Walpole was in Britain in the 1720s, when he was unable to condemn John Huntridge under the Black Act. Huntridge would have fared much less well in present-day Venezuela or Argentina. While the democracy emerging in Latin America is in principle diametrically opposed to elite rule, and in rhetoric and action, it tries to redistribute rights and opportunities away from at least a segment of the elite, its roots are firmly based in extractive regimes in two senses. First, inequities persisting for centuries under extractive regimes make voters in newly emerging democracies vote in favor of politicians with extreme policies. It is not that Argentinians are just naive and think that Juan Perón or the more recent Peronist politicians such as Menem or the Kirchners are selfless and looking out for their interests, or that Venezuelans see their salvation in Chavez. Instead, many Argentinians and Venezuelans recognize that all other politicians and parties have for so long failed to give them voice, to provide them with the most basic public services, such as roads and education, and to protect them from exploitation by local elites. So many Venezuelans today support the policies that Chavez is adopting, even if these come with corruption and waste, in the same way that many Argentinians supported Perón's policies in the 1940s and 1970s. Second, it is again the underlying extractive institutions that make politics so attractive to, and so biased in favor of, strongmen such as Perón and Chavez, rather than an effective party system producing socially desirable alternatives. Perón, Chavez, and dozens of other strongmen in Latin America are just another facet of the iron law of oligarchy. And as the name suggests, the roots of this iron law lies in the underlying elite-controlled regimes. The New Absolutism. In November 2009, the government of North Korea implemented what economists call a currency reform. Severe bouts of inflation are often the reasons for such reforms. In France, in January 1960, a currency reform introduced a new franc that was equal to 100 of the existing francs. Old francs continued in circulation, and people even quoted prices in them as the change to the new francs was gradually made. Finally, old francs ceased to be legal tender in January 2002, when France introduced the euro. The North Korean reform looked similar on the face of it. Like the French in 1960, the North Korean government decided to take two zeros off the currency. 100 old wons, the currency of North Korea, were to be worth one new won. Individuals were allowed to come forward to exchange their old currency for the newly printed currency, though this had to be done in 1 week rather than 42 years, as in the French case. Then came the catch. The government announced that no one could convert more than 100,000 won, though it later relaxed this to 500,000. 100,000 won was about $40 at the black market exchange rate. In one stroke, the government had wiped out a huge fraction of North Korean citizens' private wealth. We do not know exactly how much, but it is probably greater than that expropriated by the Argentine government in 2002. The government in North Korea is a communist dictatorship opposed to private property and markets, but it is difficult to control black markets, and black markets make transactions in cash. Of course, quite a bit of foreign exchange is involved, particularly Chinese currency, but many transactions use yuan. The currency reform was designed to punish people who use these markets, and more specifically, to make sure that they did not become too wealthy or powerful enough to threaten the regime. Keeping them poor was safer. Black markets are not the whole story. People in North Korea also keep their savings in yuans because there are few banks in Korea, and they are all owned by the government. In effect, the government used the currency reform to expropriate much of people's savings. Though the government says it regards markets as bad, the North Korean elite rather like what markets can produce for them. The leader, Kim Jong-il, has a 7-story pleasure palace equipped with a bar, a karaoke machine, and a mini movie theater. The ground floor has an enormous swimming pool with a wave machine, where Kim likes to use a bodyboard fitted with a small motor. When, in 2006, the United States placed sanctions on North Korea, it knew how to really hit the regime where it hurt. It made it illegal to export more than 60 luxury items to North Korea, including yachts, water scooters, racing cars, motorcycles, DVD players, and televisions larger than 29 inches. There would be no more silk scarves, designer fountain pens, furs, or leather luggage. These were exactly the items collected by Kim and his Communist Party elites. One scholar used sales figures from the French company Hennessy to estimate that Kim's annual cognac budget before the sanctions could have been as high as $800,000 a year. It is impossible to understand many of the poorest regions of the world at the end of the 20th century without understanding the new absolutism of the 20th century, communism. Marx's vision was a system that would generate prosperity under more humane conditions and without inequality. Lenin and his Communist Party were inspired by Marx, but the practice could not have been more different from the theory. The Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was a bloody affair, and there was no humane aspect to it. Equality was not part of the equation either, since the first thing Lenin and his entourage did was to create a new elite, themselves, at the head of the Bolshevik Party. In doing so, they purged and murdered not only non-communist elements, but also other communists who could have threatened their power. But the real tragedies were yet to come, first with the Civil War, and then under Stalin's collectivization and his all-too-frequent purges, which may have killed as many as 40 million people. Russian communism was brutal, repressive, and bloody, but not unique. The economic consequences and the human suffering were quite typical of what happened elsewhere, for example in Cambodia in the 1970s, under the Khmer Rouge, in China, and in North Korea. In all cases, communism brought vicious dictatorships and widespread human rights abuses. Beyond the human suffering and carnage, the communist regimes all set up various types of extractive institutions. The economic institutions, with or without markets, were designed to extract resources from the people, and by entirely abhorring property rights, they often created poverty instead of prosperity. In the Soviet case, as we saw in Chapter 5, the communist system at first generated rapid growth, but then faltered and led to stagnation. The consequences were much more devastating in China under Mao, in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, and in North Korea, where the communist economic institutions led to economic collapse and famine. The communist economic institutions were in turn supported by extractive political institutions, concentrating all power in the hands of communist parties and introducing no constraints on the exercise of this power. Though these were different extractive institutions in form, they had similar effects on the livelihoods of the people as the extractive institutions in Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone. King Cotton. Cotton accounts for about 45% of the exports of Uzbekistan, making it the most important crop since the country established independence at the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. Under Soviet communism, All farmland in Uzbekistan was under the control of 2,048 state-owned farms. These were broken up and the land distributed after 1991. But that didn't mean farmers could act independently. Cotton was too valuable.